First, another man who's often sung about human distress. This was and is still is Ralph McTell's signature song, Streets of London. It's notable for being one of the most covered songs by other artists in the 50 plus years since it was recorded. We'll hear Ralph's original after we talk to him, but I know he likes this version from Sinead O'Connor. Sinead's beautiful version of that. Ralph McTell, who wrote that lovely hymn to the homeless and lonely people, turns 80 this year. He was a big star once, a good-looking young folk singer with a huge hit song, and he's written many excellent songs off many albums since, but that's the one everyone remembers. Ralph is here very soon for concerts in Auckland and Christchurch. Good morning, Ralph. Very nice to have you on.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm very pleased to be with you. Yeah.
I notice it's been pretty well exactly 20 years since you were here with Steel Eye Span, I think.
Yes, I was. I didn't know it was 20 years ago, though. Goodness me, that's amazing. Yeah, that was quite a tour, and we had a lot of fun. And the day we arrived in New Zealand, Billy Connolly was playing at another theatre, so we all went up and, you know, gave him a surprise visit. It was a wonderful, because we all knew him, and it was a rather wonderful occasion, and we've got the photographs and great memories.
You've had your own music and talk show on the BBC, and Billy Connolly was one of your guests, wasn't he? And he also used one of your songs for a TV series, I think.
Yes, they did. Well, Billy was... I didn't actually have a talk show. I had a. I was persuaded against my better judgment at the time, but it turned out to be a very good decision. I did a children's series called Alphabet Zoo, which was about animals and letters. And then I did another. They created a series for me called Tickle on the Tum, like a play on words with a little village in England somewhere, where I was an unexplained lodger. And I invited guests. They would come into this little shop and tell me their adventures of the week. And when Billy heard about it, he said to me, oh, I'd love to do that. So they created a role called, I think it's called, he was the dustman anyway. I can't remember his name. And I wrote a special song for him. And we did that together. And Billy and I kind of go back such a long time. And, you know, probably 1969 when we met. So we've been long mates ever since. And then he did that wonderful tour of he called them the World Tour of New Zealand, the World Tour of Australia, World Tour of Wales and Ireland, and I was lucky enough to be invited to write some music for that, and I wrote a song for the Australian version called In the Dreamtime, which I will be playing while I'm in Australia. And I think it was John McCusker did the music for World Tour of New Zealand. But Billy and I are both very fond of being down here in the Antipodes, and we often talk about it and the feeling of kinship that we have. And it's a very special place for us.
And you recorded Unknown Soldier with spoken words from Billy and also Anthony Hopkins, didn't you?
We did. Billy, you see, I wanted to, from being a little boy, realizing what the unknown soldier signified, it was always with me. And then one day somebody said to me, well, you know, there's some footage that exists. I don't know if you'll be able to use it, of the arrival of the boy from the fields of France, or in fact, no one knows where he came from. That was all part of the mystery. And I checked out this film and I just said, I've got to do something. And if I don't do it now, it won't ever happen, because I was of a certain age. So I think it was 1919, they brought him home. And the whole ritual, sometimes British pageantry, they get it right. And in this instance, the whole thing was filmed, the exhumation of four bodies from the battlefields that were unknown, with boys with no names and couldn't be identified. And they blindfolded a general who twisted round in the chapel and pointed to a body, and that body was wrapped up and brought home. And the whole thing was just incredible. So I thought, to represent our home nations, i.e. Scotland, Ireland, England, Wales, because I'm pretty sure that he was a British soldier, that I would invite Billy to do the Scottish voice. I would do the singing. And Billy knew, Billy put me in touch with someone who knew Liam Neeson. And Liam agreed straight away to do it, because he'd known an old boy in his village up in the north of Ireland who had served in both battles of the Somme. And then I said to him, "You don't happen to know Sir Anthony Hopkins, do you?" He said, "Yeah, I did a film with him once." And we got Sir Anthony to do the Welsh voice. So, and it's on YouTube if any of your listeners want to watch it, because, you know, obviously I couldn't encompass all the Allied soldiers from all over the globe who took part in that terrible carnage. But my theme was the ones who were never identified. And at Ypres in Belgium, the names of 50,000 unidentified soldiers' names are written, because their bodies were never found. They're written on the memorial up there. And every night since the end of the First World War, seven buglers go out and play the last post. And it's one of the most incredibly moving ceremonies that you're ever likely to see.
The Menin Gate. No Kiwis there on that great list of men, actually.
No, I don't think so. But there are some Muslim soldiers and soldiers. The names you would recognise, I couldn't say for sure. You just don't have time to read 50,000 names. But I know when I looked at the wall, I felt myself welling up. There were names of boys that I'd been to school with. You know what I mean? The surnames and the first names of young lads and,
yes,
you know, not much older than 17 or 18. And it is incredibly beautiful ceremony. And the people in the city of Ypres, I played in the cathedral, managed to get through the song without weeping, just about. And then I went and played up at the Menin Gate with a friend of mine and for a special ceremony that evening, which was a high point for me. I must be honest, as a guitar player, singer, songwriter, to be invited to do that was an incredible honour.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I can imagine that. This may seem like a silly question, and it may be. Are you the only person in the world with the surname McTell?
I think so. And it's really, that's a good question. You know, I took the name from one of my guitar heroes, the beautiful singing and playing and composition of a guy called Blind Willie McTell, an old African-American musician that made lots of records in the 30s and 40s, up to the 40s, and was rediscovered in the 1960s. And I just loved his 12-string guitar playing and his beautiful voice. Of course, Bob Dylan has written a song called No One Sings the Blues Like Blind Willie McTell, which is an absolutely gorgeous song. And so when I sort of began a semi-professional career, I thought, my real name is May, M-A-Y, and I thought, well, I think it sounds better to have a double-syllable surname. I don't know who might agree or disagree, but it sounded better to me. And so when I got my record contract, wanted to change it back, they said, oh, no, McTell's a much better name. And I think they were probably right. In fact, if I have to sign anything in my real name, I have to practice it first, because I've signed so many autographs with McTell. It looks like I'm trying to forge my own signature nowadays.
People would get suspicious, wouldn't they? Oh, what's my name again?
Yes, exactly.
I thought it was, you see, I Googled it. And I saw another McTell. I thought, oh no, it's not that he isn't the only other person called McTell. But the one I saw was Blind Willie McTell's sister, I think. So, in fact...
Oh, that could be. Yeah, it could be. But I know she couldn't be possibly be alive. Yeah, it was. I think the registrar got in a tangle trying to register Willie's name, because I think he's probably his slave name or his owner's name, which most Black American people have, is from the people who once had them as slaves, was McTavish. And I don't think he could, according to research, he couldn't spell it. So he wrote McTell and created a name that is inadvertently handed to Willie and then to me.
Now, your tour, you've got it. You have a Gibson guitar, I know, from 1952. You may have more than one. Are you bringing that really well-known guitar down?
I have got, you know what, the last time I came down here to Australia anyway, the humidity and everything played havoc with it. And I have tried so hard to find another as good as that I could risk bringing, but you can imagine. But guess what? I found one, and I'm bringing that to New Zealand. It's another 1952 Gibson J45, and I just hope it will behave itself. It seems to have settled down now, but there's nothing compares to the tone of that. And you know, since you mentioned guitar, that's my driver. I love the guitar. I've always wanted to be a good guitar player. And I've just happened to have written some songs on the way, but guitar still intrigues and delights me. And I've just been playing this morning, been in my motel room. I play every day, whether I'm working or not. And I just love the sound of the acoustic guitar. And I love the sound of a Gibson J45 in particular. And I've got two of them, at least two.
Lucky.
Shall I fib? At least two I have. I bought several over the years just in case I didn't have the best one, but I think I have the best one.
I remember you played the Isle of Wight Festival. This is, you know, from your big star Top of the Bill days, because I know you used to sell out the Royal Festival Hall in London and the Royal Albert Hall, and you were Top of the Bill at the Montreux Jazz Festival. And at the Isle of Wight, you played with Leonard Cohen, I think, and Jimi Hendrix. How good was Jimmy, looking back, as a fellow guitarist?
Well, I just wish that I wish I could tell you the truth. Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. I had no idea what was going to hit me when I walked out on that stage and saw, they now estimate 500,000 people, a festival run by 25 to 28 year olds with no clue on how to manage anything. And yet it was both the beginning and end of something. All these stars, I was wearing a shirt that I'd swapped for a set of old guitar strings in Milan some years before. And I just wasn't prepared for either the impact of this or what it meant. And it took years before I realized that it was both the end and the beginning of something. And the fact that I was going to see Jimi Hendrix, who was a guitar hero of anyone that likes music, must admit to that. The festival discipline, such as it was, broke down towards the end of the evening. And my manager, who was probably quite wise and a survivalist, said, "We've got to go. This is going to get out of hand, you know, all these people and no one to shepherd it or whatever you like." And so I missed Jimmy, and I waited 25 years before I saw the show that he did. And it was worth the wait, because it does exist on film, and it's an extraordinary tour de force, really. And for me, you know, he only did one other concert after that, but I didn't see it at the time. I saw the others, but I didn't see the one I really wanted to see, which was Jimmy, but we did in the end. I never met him, but I mean, that experience is indelibly in my mind. And thankfully, there's a few photographs of it as well, so I know I was there.
Yeah, I didn't know that. It's funny how many people missed him at Woodstock, of course, because he played on the final morning from memory, and a whole lot of people had gone, had traipsed off from Woodstock as well.
Yes, it's extraordinary. That it all adds to the myth and the magic of the man, you know.
Unassuming is an adjective pinned on you all the time in publicity, and it's one that kind of implies meekness, and you're not meek by any means. And I mean, for example, during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, you'd play there when nobody else was prepared to. Did you ever have any bother doing that, by the way, just looking back?
Only the emotional one, you know. Like one time, I walked out on stage and at the height of the Troubles, and God knows they were hellish, you know, for the poor people who lived amongst them. And I'm not drawing any distinction between them. People are people, and but of course, you know, you don't know who's come to your gig, whether they're Republican sympathisers or you know, union sympathizers, that once you get in and you're playing music, the whole place stood up before I played a single note and gave me a 5-minute ovation or
Wow.
something. And you know, you just, and I would say to people, for goodness sake, go, these people are one of the most wonderful audiences, and they need music. They need music. They need you to come over and do it. But in a band situation, you only need one of the members to say, I'm sorry, I don't feel I should go. And then the band can't go. So I think there was a bit of that. And I think there would have been more musicians that would have gone if the whole band had been prepared to. But there were others who did it too. And the rewards are not financial, but they are part of the history of what I do. And I'm not trying to milk it. I love playing in Ireland. In fact, I've just been over and done a 3-week tour of North and South in the Republic and in the North, and loved every minute of it.
Which was an important thing for you to do, but there is also the matter of the title of the album, Hill of Beans, and I'm assuming you borrowed it from the movie Casablanca and Humphrey Bogart said it, and that implies that
Oh.
that whatever you and I manage to do in life, it's not going to be very important or permanent in the great scheme of things. That's what I took from the title.
Well, you've got it right. You've got it absolutely. That's exactly what I meant. When you get to live as long as I have, and you don't die the rock and roll death, and you're still knocking on in your late 70s like I am, you look at art and the way it's banded about, and its importance. To me, I dispute that. I think art is important to the individual or the artist, and possibly to a few appreciate, but it changes very little. It only alters style, in my opinion. I mean, for me, I'm deeply moved by certain paintings. But when everybody, for example, I'm probably going to get some flack for this, that Guernica is one of the greatest war paintings ever. I don't get that. I seen pictures when I was much younger. I was just thinking this morning of Salvador Dali's Premonition of the Spanish Civil War, which shocked me, shook me to my boots. That's a painting and a half that depicts civil, you know, unrest and division better than anything that, like Guernica. So really, the thing that inspired it was, I was reading a book about, it's called The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, but it was written by her partner, Gertrude Stein. And already there's a play on words. It's all smarty and very clever and all that, or not. Is it nonsense? So while I was writing the song of them discovering Pablo Picasso and Georges Braque and their little salon in the middle of France, in the middle of Paris, sorry, on the Rue Fleurus, there were soldiers in trenches down the road, shivering and being shot at. And, you know, they were rattling around with it and having their prattling and going on, and the great philosophy of art and painting and everything. Yes, that it's right, but I wanted to mix as many things up in one song as I could. It's on the same album. And to be truthful, that in the end, the lives of three little people don't, that's, I thought Bogart's speech at the end was superb. So I took it and wove it into the tune that I had. And I mean, I'm always tempted to break into, you must remember that, you know, that a kiss is just a kiss, a smile is, you know, as time goes by. But I don't. I want it to stand on its own. But I very seldom play it because it's quite tricky for me. I'm not a pianist, although I'd like to be. But it's my reflections on art, having had a long time to think about it. Yes, it's essential, but it changes nothing.
I don't know. I mean, 200 cover versions of Streets of London, and I think you ditched the song for a while for obvious reasons. But you know, you're tired of playing it, but you couldn't ditch it
I'm
forever.
no, no, I'm not. No, I'm not tired of playing
No, I
it.
don't mean
I'm
you are
definitely
now. I don't
not.
mean you are now, but
I did get to be a little bit. It's actually, apparently it's nearer four. It's 400 plus, I think.
oh, is
So if somebody has recalculated, so it's gone up. Yeah, a lot of people have done it.
The thing is that my point was going to be that it's a song that will still be referred to, I would think, in 21, 24, and unearthed and heard, even as an historical document. And a whole lot of people now won't be recipients of that honour with their songs. So I think you actually have achieved a kind of immortality in that sense.
Well, wouldn't that be wonderful that, you know, that's got nothing. I always say that Streets of London seems to have its own career because it doesn't change. It is there and it exists. Whereas the artist in me, if that's not too grand a word, continues to strive to write not a follow-up, just keep trying to write better songs and keep your standards high and not pander to what you could perceive to be the commercial. But I always describe Streets of London as a little blip in my graph that suddenly connected when I was quite young, and it's been difficult sometimes to move past it. But you know, when you look back, as I do frequently now, there's so much to look back to that I realize this is what I've done with my life. This
Yeah.
is what I've done. I've chosen to play the acoustic guitar, travel the world, share songs, write songs. And I think I've been very fortunate. And I might have written a song that might outlast me. Well, that's the cherry on the cake.
Oh, that's absolutely certain. And you have a happy family. Does it feel strange to have lived that life completely music oriented? Because sliding doors, what if your family had moved to Australia if your dad hadn't run off and left you in the lurch? Because you nearly immigrated. What would you have done, do you think?
I know that the one thing I do know, I would not have been able to work inside. I'd have to be an outside person because that's still my thing. I mean, if I wasn't playing music, I'd have to work outside. I've often thought that just as Bob Dylan's art has shaped the man, even though you only got to go back and look at his early pictures to see he looked a fairly conventional middle-class boy from the Midwest. Once he started writing songs and copying Woody Guthrie, slowly this new image emerges, and his work has shaped him to the man, the genius that he is now. And I think work, the fact that I stayed in England, and we did suffer the rotten weather, and we did have the deprivation of not enough to eat, and we did have the struggle of a single parent family in tough times after the war, made me sensitive to other people, made me kind of think about things from a very early age. In fact, I've tried to date when I first saw the image of the old boy in the market in Croydon, which is where I grew up, apparently nonchalantly kicking through the debris after a market day, but he was actually looking for stuff. And I think I was 10, so I certainly know that my observation had begun at that time about other people, and the fact that we had somewhere to live, and though things were tough, we had a very strong mum, my brother and I, and we had a sensibility of others that were possibly worse off than us from quite an early age. And so I think I would have been a different bloke if I'd had a dad. In fact, my brother, who was a very wise man, just before he passed away, nearly 2 years ago, the coming May, 18 months ago, he said to me, "You know, the best thing that ever happened to you and me, Ralph," he said, "we grew up without a dad, because we it's not always the case, because fatherless boys do tend to wander, but so did we. But we had good wandering, you know,
Yeah.
not aggressive. We had good wandering, and we learned to be men and dads without a guide. And it made us who we are. So events, I think, I do believe in the mixture of nature and nurture. So I think what happened to us made us the men we are or
So
were.
there was an old man. I've never known. I wondered if it was a composite kind of,
Now, there are
portrayal.
three old men, three different men,
Yeah, but the one that
actually.
opens the song.
The one that owns, he was real, absolutely real. I can see him now when I close my eyes. And the other old guy, actually, the only cheat in that song is the words "Seaman's Mission," because the where I saw this old boy with his medal ribbons was at a working men's hostel, which was, cheap lodging at the end of a street where I lived. It was like it used to be a couple of bob a night to stay there, and they let this old boy stay on. And you can't fit in working men's hostel, so I changed it to Seaman's Mission because it was a short of syllables, but the image has the same effect, I think.
Streets of London is bang on relevant again. In fact, it's never lost its relevance. But other songs of yours that aren't heard a lot have huge relevance now as well, I think. Bentley and Craig, for example, about the execution of a boy who didn't kill anyone. There'll be people who know that song well, but most people possibly won't ever hear it.
Well, that's absolutely true. I always wanted to have a big cause to write about. And when Woody Guthrie addressed his writing, because he was a big influence on me too, I suddenly thought, well, we have the most hideous case of injustice right here in Croydon, where I grew up. And in fact, my mum admitted to me that she'd actually met Derek, and she knew Iris, his sister, and he was a simple boy, had to have a little note to go shopping with, you know, your listeners will now be curious as to, they have to find the song somewhere, because I think this album that it's on has been deleted. But I did play it one night here in Australia, where I'm speaking to you from, and it was extraordinary, the reaction to it. And when I've done it abroad, people think, you got it wrong in the song lyric. I said, no, that's the whole point of the song, that the guy that didn't do it got executed, and the boy that did it, he might even still be alive. He'd be in his mid-80s now if he was still alive.
And they knew the truth. The authorities knew the truth, that he hadn't done the killing.
Oh yes, absolutely. But someone had to pay. You know, the war had only been over a little while. It was a policeman that shouldn't have actually been there that got shot in the incident. And I don't think there was any forensic evidence on the bullets that were fired either. They just needed to make an example of someone, and they couldn't do it to the boy that allegedly fired the shot, so they did it to his accomplice, saying that he was, even though he had a mental age of 8 years old and was an epileptic boy with very special needs, you know, they took his life at age 18 or 19.
And people can look up Bentley and Craig and find out the whole story.
The story, it's an incredible story, but be prepared to be, there are also add-ons to the story that recent research has revealed, which are just as horrifying. But I must say that finally, Iris, Derek's sister, who campaigned relentlessly for 40-odd years for a pardon, was denied to see the pardon. She passed away before, but we did meet, and I sang at her funeral. And when Derek was finally given a royal pardon, his remains, such as they might have been, were exhumed, and he was brought to a cemetery in Croydon, and I sang Bentley and Craig at the recommittal.
You're a good man, Ralph McTell.
Well, what else could we do? We could try to be good. I've got plenty of weaknesses, I can assure you. But no, justice from a little boy, justice. I mean, what better message could an 8-year-old have? Because that's how old I was, to try and understand what was going on there. So I've always had a good sense of fair play, I think.
Let's get on to a couple of areas where you may not have been that good, although I have no idea what these stories involve, but I saw the publicity blurb for your tour. It says you once hitchhiked with Rod Stewart and you got into a crap game with Tom Waits in LA. So two questions.
Yeah.
Did anything interesting happen with Rod Stewart, and did you lose money to
Tom
Waits?
No, he was far too self-absorbed, and he was with a guy that I know he would love to find. We used to call him Italian Tony. He was a Cockney boy, just like the rest of us. And he was, the two of them were already in the car that I stopped. The guy picked us up and I went in the back with them. But Rod was a very self-absorbed young man. And he was apparently those who had money used to hitchhike out of London to the local railway station and get on the milk train and go down to Brighton. It's only 50 miles away. And we just sit about on the beach, being in, you know, windswept and interesting, so we thought, as beatniks, you know. they were called weekend ravers by some, but there were some real beatniks, guys that lived on their wits and wrote poems that nobody would read. And Rod was attracted to that, and I remember that incident. It's even funnier with the story about Tom Waits. I was in a bar that I had played in Los Angeles called the Troubadour, which is in LA, and he walks in, and I recognised him straight away because I loved his first album and had actually recorded one of his songs. And he just sat down at the table I was sitting at. He said, "Yeah, man, you play craps?" And I said, "No." He said, "You want to? I'll teach you how to play." And I said, "Okay." And I was smiling to myself because Tom is always in theatre. Do you know what I mean? He's always in costume.
Yeah.
He's always living the part. So he's a middle-class boy too, but he lives the part But what a musician and what a writer of melody, and what a he's better at the beat poetry than the beat poets were. I think he's an extraordinary performer. Anyway, he taught me to play craps, and he's a gentleman because I let him win $5. I wasn't really interested. I was just intrigued by the whole theatrical process, you know, and he'll never know unless you tell him.
I won't tell him. It's just between you and me. Look, lovely to have you touring. So you're 80 at the end of this year. I bet you don't feel it.
No, I'm starting to creak a bit. I've got to be honest, but I've when you get to this age, you don't get away with it all entirely. But I must be honest, I've been very fortunate, and I'm reasonably fit. I find the travelling is more exhausting than it used to be, but as soon as I get on stage, it's all worth it, you know. And I'm doing better than a lot of folks. And I'm clinging to this adage that old age is a privilege not granted to everyone. So that's I'm clinging to that. So I'm doing all right.
And that is true as well. Always nice to hear that song again, which we will, from you, Ralph, and lovely to talk to you about the past.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for some great questions, and I'm really looking forward to my trip over very shortly. Saying for several years now, this might be my last time, but something comes up, and here I am again. So I'm not going to say goodbye. It's just farewell, and we'll carry on.
Indeed, indeed. All right, lovely to have met you too. Thank you.
And you, thanks very much,
Okay.
and bye bye for now.
Bye bye.